I'm late. I had to stop by the Wax Museum again and give the finger to FDR.
We know Al-Qaeda, Zawahiri, is supporting the opposition in Syria. Are we supporting Al-Qaeda in Syria?
Well, it's a proud day for America. And by God, we've kicked Vietnam Syndrome once and for all. Thank you very, very much.
I say it again. You've been had. You've been took. You've been hoodwinked.
These witnesses are trying to simply deny things that just about everybody else accepts as fact.
He came, he saw, and died.
But we ain't killing their army, but we killing them. We be on CNN like, say our name, Ben, say it three times.
The meeting of the largest armies in the history of the world. Then there's going to be an invasion.
All right, you guys, introducing Alan J. Cooperman. He is a professor of public affairs at UT Austin, and he is the author of The Limits of Humanitarian Intervention and co-editor of Gambling on Humanitarian Intervention. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, Alan?
I'm fine. Thanks for having me back.
Good. Happy to have you here. And on my favorite subject that I've read you write on, at least, Libya and how the war all started back in 2011. Famously, you wrote for the Boston Globe, false pretense for war in Libya back in 2011, April the 14th, 2011. And now you've got this follow-up here in the National Interest. I'm skipping a few, I know. Here's one in the National Interest, brand new. America's little-known mission to support Al-Qaeda's role in Libya. I have a feeling the editor added in apostrophe S role there. But anyway, so yeah, good stuff. So you went back and decided, I guess, to ask what could have been known about who the so-called rebels in the Libya war were and when in 2011?
Yeah, I mean, I've been on this case for 7 years, and the hardest thing to figure out was who actually started the uprising in Libya, because the story was that this was a nonviolent protest led by lawyers and human rights activists, and that because the Libyan leader Gaddafi overreacted to that supposedly and attacked those peaceful protesters, these lawyers and housewives quickly got together and formed a rebel army and captured half the country in a week. And that always made no sense to me. And yet I could not figure out who actually started the uprising. But after 7 years of research, I figured it out.
All right. Well, so tell us about that research then.
Okay. So, you know, I had had research assistants for years. I'd been doing my own research, looking at everything that was published, and no one ever talked about who it was that had actually launched the uprising. And what I eventually figured out was that some of these rebels in the smartphone era had videoed themselves and posted these videos online, usually in real time. And no one had really gone through them in any sort of rigorous way. So I got this great research assistant who was fluent in Arabic, and we went through these things. And what we were able to do then is piece together exactly who did what when in that first week. And what we found out is that this was not lawyers and housewives, but this was a bunch of veterans of Al-Qaeda who had launched previous rebellions in Libya and who had joined Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan and in Iraq. And in 2011, they are the ones who actually launched this uprising against Gaddafi. And in fact, they planned it even before any peaceful protest started. So this was not a peaceful protest that then became violent. This was a violent Al-Qaeda uprising right from the start.
Mm-hmm. Well, I hope you got that plug-in where you can download and save all those videos on your own hard drive so that they don't get all tossed down into the memory hole later on when you want to go back and show us. But so now, can you tell us about Derna and about the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group and what exactly we're talking about here? Al-Qaeda in Iraq from Iraq War II?
Yeah, so Eastern Libya was not just a hotbed of radical jihadis in Libya, but was actually probably the most radical Islamist part of the entire Arab world. And part of the evidence for that is that when U.S. forces in Iraq captured records in 2007, known as the Sinjar records, they found out that the small city in eastern Libya called Derna was the most concentrated source of foreign fighters in Iraq for Al-Qaeda of any place in the world. And so this place in Libya, Derna, had also been the capital of an uprising, a militant Islamist uprising in Libya in the 1990s. So these folks had fought in Afghanistan, had fought in Iraq, had fought in Libya, and Gaddafi had gradually rounded all these people up and thrown them in jail in the 90s and the 2000s. But then he made this fatal mistake, which was on the advice of his son, he decided to try to have a reconciliation with these jihadis. And he released them from prison during the period of 2007 to 2010. And he did so when they pledged, we promise, we've given up violence, we will only use peaceful means. He released them from prison, and their thanks to him were that they launched this rebellion, and they captured him, they tortured him, and they killed him.
Hey, y'all, here's the thing. Donate $100 to the Scott Horton Show, and you can get a QR code commodity disc as my gift to you. It's a 1 ounce silver disc with a QR code on the back. You take a picture of it with your phone, and it gives you the instant spot price and lets you know what that silver, that ounce of silver, is worth on the market in Federal Reserve notes in real time. It's the future of currency in the past, too. CommodityDiscs.com, or just go to ScottHorton.org/donate. And now these guys, I guess, take it. What weeks are we talking about here? You talk about this one very first week when the uprising started and who started it. Which week was this again?
This is 2011, February, and the week that I focus on is the start of the uprising, February 15th to 21st, 2011. And all of the Western media reports said, oh, this is a peaceful protest in Benghazi, and Gaddafi has sent in his thugs, and they're just killing hundreds or thousands of innocent civilians. And that reporting was dead wrong. There were peaceful protests, it's true, but the real action was this militant uprising. And Gaddafi was not targeting peaceful protesters. He was targeting the militant uprising. And in fact, at the beginning, most of the people who were dying or being injured were Gaddafi's security forces, because they were not using deadly force at the beginning, but the militants were using deadly force at the beginning. And so within a week, these jihadis had captured the entire eastern coast of Libya. Almost all the people in Libya live on the coast. So if you capture the eastern coast, you've essentially captured half the country. And then they launched their march towards the capital over the next couple weeks. And then Gaddafi responded militarily and pushed back the militants, and essentially had nearly defeated the jihadis by a few weeks later in early March 2011. And that's when the UN decided to authorize intervention, and President Obama decided to lead this military intervention in mid-March 2011, which he argued was going to prevent genocide and was going to come to the rescue of this liberal uprising. But in fact, there was no genocide, because Gaddafi was not targeting civilians. And the U.S. didn't come to the rescue of liberal Democrats. They came to the rescue of these Al-Qaeda veterans and help them come to power a few months later.
Mm-hmm. And now, and it took like 9 months to finally finish the regime change operation from there, right?
October 2011, months after the intervention started, the U.S. and its NATO allies in Qatar and Sudan and others helped the rebels finally get enough power and degraded Gaddafi's forces sufficiently that they were able to capture the capital. Mm-hmm. Gaddafi fled south and east, and eventually a couple weeks later they found him. The rebels found him and then killed him. And of course, Libya since then has been a basket case. It is anarchy. It has three different governments that claim to be the legitimate government in Libya. It has hundreds of different little militia groups that have been fighting each other. It now has a military officer who is leading a new attack on the capital, and he claims to be fighting jihadis, but he actually has some jihadis in his midst as well. And the country's economy has been in free fall. It used to have the highest standard of living of any country in Africa, and now it can't even have electricity in most of its major cities for much of the day. So it's just been a total disaster. Over 10,000 people have been killed. Hundreds of thousands of people have been displaced from their homes. And of course, we have Al-Qaeda in Libya, and we even have the Islamic State in Libya. And all of this is the result of this, you know, misguided U.S.-led intervention in 2011, which, you know, as I say, I sincerely think the Obama administration thought they were helping liberal Democrats overthrow a dictator. But in fact, what they were doing was helping Al-Qaeda veterans to try to take over the country.
Hey guys, Scott here for Liberty Under Attack Publications. Looking for a liberty-focused publisher? Liberty Under Attack publishes books and strategy guides for individuals looking to increase their personal freedom. They assist authors through the entire publishing process, proofreading, editing, cover designs, paperback and Kindle formatting, and full audiobook narration and post-production. Tell them Scott sent you and get 20% off a full-service deal. To get some one-of-a-kind books or for more information, visit libertyunderattack.com. Well, we do know that Hillary had that all-important meeting at a hotel in France with this one Libyan Chalabi who told her, don't worry, everything's going to be fine. And so that was worth 10 years of PNAC agitation right there, one meeting, and she was on board for the whole thing.
Well, you know, it's not clear what the Obama administration and the key officials in this, what they knew. So the key officials were a woman named Samantha Power, who was a special assistant and who had, you know, her claim to fame is writing a book about how the U.S. should intervene to stop genocide and how easy it is. I agree with her that the U.S., if it can, should intervene to stop genocide. But I very, very strongly disagree with her that it's easy. And I also point out that sometimes if you do it wrong, you make matters worse. And Libya is now a poster child for that. In any case, she was in the White House at the time.
She's a poster child, too, for the bureaucratic self-interest here, whereas Michael Hastings reported that she was tired of, quote, do-gooder rinky-dink stuff like Iraqi reconciliation, which was her assignment on the National Security Council. She wanted a promotion, and she wanted an opportunity to demonstrate her theory about intervening in African genocides and all this. And so basically trumped up this narrative for her own purposes. And this is
She trumped it up, or one could argue that she just misperceived it because she maybe had a psychological inclination to misperceive it. She had an interest.
I understand that you're being very generous.
So I'm not sure. I doubt very much that she intentionally was misleading others.
How about when Barack Obama
was misled?
How about when Barack Obama said that it's just like if the city of Charlotte, North Carolina was about to be wiped off the map and every civilian in that city killed, that's what's about to happen in Benghazi and that's why we have to intervene. Was that also a mistake? I mean, I understand you're being polite and professional.
I think Samantha Power probably made that case to him. Susan Rice, who was also a senior official in the White House and who also had for many, many years said that she had failed to stop the Rwandan genocide when she was in the White House in the 90s and that she was never going to make that mistake again. So these folks, Samantha Power, Susan Rice, they were primed. They wanted to stop a genocide. And so they saw an impending genocide where there was not one. They launched an intervention to stop a genocide that actually was never going to happen. And the consequence was that they got thousands and thousands of people killed, destroyed a country, and made that country a safe haven for Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State.
Yeah. Now,
one of my big questions is how is it possible that they didn't realize that the uprising was being led by jihadis, not by liberal Democrats?
Or maybe did they figure it out? Is the more appropriate thing, because they must have known at some point. Right.
Well, that's right. And we don't know the answer to that question because all of the internal U.S. government documents are still classified, and they will be for another couple decades.
But not all of them, though.
The way I put it in this article is that there's two possibilities. One is that the intelligence community blew it, that they just didn't realize what was going on, that they were fooled, and they were saying, yep, these are liberal Democrats, these are our folks, these are going to be great allies down the road, there's going to be a genocide otherwise, we need to intervene. That's one possibility. The other possibility is that the intelligence community got it right, that they figured out right away, hey, we know Eastern Libya, we know Derna, these are jihadis, these are Al-Qaeda veterans, we need to be really careful and not support this uprising. And for some reason, the folks in the White House ignored that counsel because, they didn't trust the intelligence community, or they were too lazy to read the intelligence guidance, and they instead were reading the New York Times and watching, CNN and saying, oh my God, this is a genocide against liberal Democrats. We need to intervene. So those are the two main possibilities, and we really need to figure it out. And what I call for in the article is we need an inspector general in the U.S. government, whether it be in the State Department or whether it be in the White House, to figure out what the hell happened. How did we screw the pooch so badly on this one so we can make reforms so that it never happens again?
Hmm. Well, I understand.
That's a technical term of art, by the way. Screw the pooch.
Yeah, I got it. And listen, I think that I agree with you so much about the self-delusion here and the whole thing about you can't get someone to understand what their salary depends on them not understanding Upton Sinclair's famous quote and all of that. I get that. My job is pointing out that, hey, these guys are Al-Qaeda in Iraq guys. And so I was doing that right away. But the thing is, it seems to me like maybe one of the big mistakes that we make, one of the big reforms that we need is to stop giving these people the benefit of the doubt so much. I mean, the fact of the matter is, I can just remember, never mind double checking, but we knew from the very beginning of this war before the UN resolution that Al-Qaeda guys were involved. And we have the emails now from Hillary Clinton, some of the emails released by the State Department and so forth. Posted on WikiLeaks. I'm not sure which all ones were leaked by who. But in any case, where we know that Sidney Blumenthal, who was helping to agitate for the war, was also warning that there's a bunch of Libyan Islamic fighting group, Al-Qaeda type terrorists there in the East. We have to be real careful. By the way, they're rounding up and killing black people, claiming that they're all mercenaries of Gaddafi, which was true and which should have been a reason to call the whole thing off right then and there, but it wasn't. And this is in very early April. But before that, you know, Michael Scheuer, the former chief of the CIA's Bin Laden unit, on March 31st, went on CNN and said, well, look, yes, the CIA are talking to people who aren't jihadis, but that's just because the jihadis aren't talking to the CIA. But this is their war. And that's essentially whose side we're taking in this thing. And right, got in a big fight point, with the CNN point, ladies about
already,
it.
By that point, Scott, we had already intervened. The point of my article is that we should have realized that, and perhaps the intelligence community realized that even before we intervened. And so that's what we really need to figure out.
Well,
did the intel folks in the U.S. government know that this was a jihadi uprising before President Obama decided to help the uprising? Mm-hmm. And my guess is probably so, but we'll need to find out. But if you want to take a look at the evidence, so in my new National Interest article, you know, it's a short piece and there's no footnotes, but I have a longer academic article and I have all the footnotes. I have, you know, you talked about the videos. I've got links to the videos on YouTube. I've got photos, screenshots from videos that were posted at the time prior to the intervention. So you can take a look at that. It's an article in Genocide Studies and Prevention that I wrote, and it's linked at my website, which is Cooperman.com. It's like Superman, but with a K, Cooperman.com. You can go there and you can take a look at all the YouTube videos that you know, the question is, did our intel community have the sense to be looking at this sort of stuff and figuring this out? Did we have contacts on the ground? Did we know what was going on prior to the intervention? It's very easy to say everybody knew after we intervened and the jihadis came out of the woodwork, and then it was very clear that there were jihadis there. But you could argue, well, they came later. They didn't, you know, they hijacked.
I hear you.
A peaceful protest.
It ain't much later when it's still.
They were the rebellion from day one. And the question is, you know, why did the folks in Obama's administration not realize that?
Still, when everybody knew by the end of March, that was still plenty of time to call off the war. And they didn't. So either way, I mean, don't get me wrong, your point is a great one. But I'm just saying, as we talked about, the war lasted until the fall. And
sure.
Hassidi saying, yeah, I'm a friend of Bin Laden's and I fought in Afghanistan and Iraq. What of it? And that's from March. He's telling that to the Telegraph. So.
Sure. No, I agree with you. And of course, you know, I've written about that, you know, previously in previous articles about the fact that we didn't give peace a chance. We didn't, even after we started the intervention, we did not negotiate in good faith with Gaddafi. We could have figured out a deal, a power sharing deal, where he would have become a figurehead and power would have been shared between, you know, there were a few liberals in the revolutionary movement. They perhaps could have been brought in, and Gaddafi's son, Saif, you know, had been making calls for liberalization for many years. So there was a soft landing here that would have been possible, that would not have destroyed Libya, that would not have helped jihadis come to power. And you're absolutely right that the Obama administration not only didn't pursue those peaceful negotiated outcomes, but undermined and put out an edict saying no negotiations, we want to defeat Gaddafi. And so you're absolutely right that there were, even after we intervened, started the intervention, there were opportunities for smarter strategy that we didn't pursue. But you know, the one thing we've never known before is who actually started the uprising. And so that's why I'm really focused on prior to the intervention. How did we not realize prior to the intervention who these folks were that were starting the rebellion? And they were our arch enemies. They were not our friends. We should never have intervened on their behalf.
Yeah, but see, there's a big wrinkle there, right? Where the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group was an asset of the CIA and the MI6, and they used them to try to kill Gaddafi. The Brits, I guess, used them to try to kill Gaddafi around the turn of the century. And then called that policy off after September 11th. And then you would have thought, especially after Iraq War II, and all those Libyans went to fight on Zarqawi's side against the Americans, that of course the CIA knew about the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group and their allies, Ansar al-Sharia and their other allies, are now on steroids after all that George Bush has done for them, giving them Western Iraq to grow and train in for all those years during that war. It was undeniable that that's who they were.
You would think so. You would think that... And in fact,
we know that the Manchester bombing in England was done by an LIFG jihadi, the son of one, who was recruited by the MI6 to go and fight in the war. And then they brought him home and he killed those girls at the concert. So they knew who the LIFG was. They were living in Manchester.
Yeah, I mean, there's the U.S. intelligence community knew who the LIFG was. They knew that Eastern Libya was this hotbed of jihadis. They knew that Gaddafi had released all these folks in the preceding years. And so when this uprising started, I got to believe if I'm a Libya officer in the U.S. intelligence community, the first thing I say to myself is, uh-oh. You know, we got a new al-Qaeda in Libya. Mm-hmm. And how that did not get through to the powers that be in the White House, no pun intended, but Samantha mm-hmm. Power, Susan Rice, Hillary Clinton, and the president. It's just it just screams out for an investigation. Mm-hmm. And if the administration won't do it with an inspector general, then Congress should do it. For years we had that crazy Benghazi investigation on the Hill that was all about, an alleged conspiracy that got four Americans killed. And of course it's horrible that four Americans got killed, but that pales in comparison to the real scandal, which was the launching of this intervention in the first place in 2011 that not just got 10,000 people killed, but created a haven for al-Qaeda and the Islamic State. Mm-hmm. That is the real scandal, and no one has ever investigated why the hell the U.S. government launched this intervention. Nobody. And you know why? Because this intervention was supported by both the Democrats and the Republicans.
That's right.
And so neither party has an interest in doing an investigation that shows that they screwed up.
Well, and it was essentially, it was a PR stunt.
The U.S. people, the American people, have an interest in that happening, and they should demand that the Trump administration and Congress launch such investigations to figure out how it screwed up so that it never happens again.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we know the answer that after especially, Tunisia, but especially the uprising in Egypt, where it was clearly against an American-backed military dictator, they had to muddy the water and confuse the issue and look like heroes helping the little guy overthrow the evil dictator just for the American people's consumption. The rest of the world could probably see right through it. And we have quote after quote after quote of Samantha Power, or especially Hillary Clinton and Anne-Marie Slaughter, and quite a few others saying that that's why we have to do this, is to show that we're against the dictators, even though we back every dictator in the region. This guy's expendable, essentially.
You're absolutely right. That was a very, very strong motivation for both the French and the U.S. government, that they appear to have been on the wrong side of the Arab Spring in Tunisia and in Egypt, and they wanted to get on the right side of history. So you clearly have a motivation and to have a bias in how you perceive things, but still, you should pay attention to what your intel community is telling you. And if the intel community was saying, hey, don't do this one, I don't care what your political motivations are, this one is against the U.S. interest, then we need to know that. And we need to figure out, who ignored the intel. Mm-hmm. And if it turns out that the intel community didn't get it right, then that's a scandal too. And so we need to figure out, who screwed up? Did the intel community screw up, or did the Obama administration screw up?
Hey guys, Scott here. I've got some books you should read. The War State by Mike Swanson, a great history of the early Cold War. No Dev, No Ops, No IT by Hussein Badakhshani. How to run your computer business like a good libertarian. Oh yeah, and don't forget Fool's Errand, Time to End the War in Afghanistan by me. Hey, let me ask you this. I think the best stuff that I know of, I mean, other than some of the emails that were released about, you know, that showed what Hillary knew and when about who these guys were. The best thing I know of where we actually got some secrets was this Washington Times series from back in 2015. But I don't remember anymore. I know it showed that the CIA and the Defense Department both were trying to stop the State Department from starting a war. Shaking my head over here. But I forget now whether that detail was in there, whether this was one of their warnings or not. Do you remember from that?
Yeah, so the great quote in that, it was a three-part series in the Washington Times, and the great quote in that series was where a former official says that the decision to intervene was a quote-unquote intelligence-light decision. So, you know, so what is, but it's not clear what that means. Does that mean that we didn't know what was going on and we just took a shot in the dark, or that we did know what was going on and we ignored the intelligence? And so it's a little bit ambiguous, but clearly this official was saying that the intel community did not support the decision to intervene. And of course, as you said, the Department of Defense also did not support the decision to intervene. You know, the Secretary of Defense, Bob Gates, said at the time, you know, I think having U.S. forces involved in war in two Islamic countries at the moment is enough. We don't really need to have a third.
Right. Then he clicked his heels and ordered the war anyway instead of resigning. But anyway.
Well, you know, good, you know, some, you know, people in government have a choice. They either, you know, follow the commander in chief or they resign. And a lot of people just have a patriotic feeling that even if they think it's a bad idea, they should be there to implement it than somebody else. But it's a really hard decision, and I'm sure it's one of the hardest decisions that Gates ever had.
Well, you know, it's important too that in the scheme of things here, where anyone who doesn't have weapons of mass destruction and falls out of favor will get you. And even Gaddafi had been out of favor since the 80s and had been begging to come back in from the cold since at least 96. Gary Hart wrote an article years ago about how in 1996, the Libyans came begging to come back in from the cold. Bush finally lets them come back in 2003 in the name of them giving up some old centrifuge junk they'd bought from Pakistan. And then because he didn't have anything like a nuclear deterrent or even a possible one, it was easy for Barack Obama to turn around and stab him right in the back. And what message does that send to Iran or North Korea or anybody else other than you better get your hands on some atom bombs?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, U.S. policy on non-proliferation has been, you know, undermined most by the Libya case, but one could argue also by the, you know, President Trump's approach to Iran.
Right.
In both cases, the country, after we pressured them, agreed to either give up their weapons of mass destruction program or to freeze their weapons of mass destruction program. And instead of rewarding them for complying with our demand, we then turn around and punish them. In the case of Gaddafi, we arm rebels who, you know, capture, torture, and kill him. And in the case of Iran, after they complied with the deal, we turn around and impose, you know, the worst sanctions ever.
Yeah. Same thing with Saddam in Iraq, too.
So, you know, at the same time, when North Korea actually gets nuclear weapons, then all, you know, President Trump just appeases them and says, oh, you know, I'll meet with you, you know, whatever you want to meet, and I'll cancel military exercises. So the lesson for, you know, these rogue states is don't give up your weapons of mass destruction program, but make sure you acquire weapons of mass destruction, because you will preserve your regime and you'll actually get appeasement from the United States. So this is exactly backwards. Yeah. We should reward those who give up WMD, and we should punish those who insist on acquiring WMD. So it's just, you know, it's you know, it's rank incompetence.
Can I ask you one more question that's totally off topic here?
Oh, you can ask.
What's with all the militarism at the University of Texas lately?
What are you talking about?
Well, they have this whole new war college thingamajig there. Can you please tell me about it? I don't know anything, but I should.
We have a new war college?
Yeah, Institute for the Study of Starting Wars or Getting Stuck in Them or something. I forget the exact title of it.
I am not familiar.
All right. Well, you know what? If I knew the exact title of what I was talking about, it would be a lot better for asking you about it.
But you know,
it was a whole thing, Admiral McRaven and all of that, right? You don't know?
You know, I don't think that becoming experts on military affairs makes you a warmonger. You know, I have a PhD in political science. I have studied many, many wars. I teach courses on military strategy. I have published analyses of military interventions around the world, whether it's Libya or Rwanda or the Balkans or Liberia. Studying war does not make you a warmonger.
Well, it depends who's paying your bills,
and in
right?
In fact, if you don't study military affairs, then you are disarmed in the intellectual battle over, you know, whether we should use force, and if so, how we should use force. So I always tell my students, in fact, we have orientation coming next week at the LBJ School where I teach at UT. I always tell my students, whether you're a hawk or whether you're a dove, you should study two things. One, study military affairs, and study negotiation. So you know both when and how military force can do good or harm, and you know when and how negotiation can do good or harm. You have to have both tools in your tool belt if you want to be able to make optimal policy decisions going forward. So, you know, we have ROTC at the University of Texas. We have an intelligence studies project at the University of Texas. We have the Robert Strauss Center for International Security and Law based at the LBJ School. And, you know, we have a lot of veterans and even some active duty students at the LBJ School getting masters in global policy studies. And, you know, I think that's great. I do not think that makes us warmongers at all. I think it helps to make us informed citizens that can then participate, intelligently in policy debates. Mm.
Well, doesn't it matter if they're giant grants from the Pentagon or not, or, you know, the level of interaction between the universities and the DOD and how fine a point people are putting on, well, whether we're talking about overall strategy or more focused on what kind of tactics we're using to implement strategies that are already decided on and these kinds of things?
There's a difference between basic research and then, you know, policy decisions. So you might have, I don't know if you were referring to, but in, you know, the Army has created this thing called the Army Futures Command.
That's what I was thinking of.
Based in Austin, Texas. It's not based at UT, but it's based in Austin. And one of the reasons it's based in Austin is that these folks want to look at, you know, technological innovation and how it could aid the Pentagon. And, you know, UT and Austin more broadly is a tech hub. So this was the idea that the Army had, they say. You know, so they're clearly trying to figure out how U.S. technology innovations can assist weaponry and intelligence and cyber and all sorts of things like that. But weapons can be used for offense or they can be used for defense. And so simply the fact that the Army is interested in this and that some people in Austin, you know, are willing to cooperate with the Pentagon does not make them warmongers. In fact, they might come up with a technological innovation that's going to allow the U.S. to better deter war. Yeah. Okay, so I would urge you to and your listeners to, you know, to keep that in mind, that not every, and I don't have any Pentagon contracts, but not every Pentagon contract is something that is going to make war more likely. it might very well make war less likely.
It's very unlikely to challenge the idea of American military global dominance, right? It's very unlikely to challenge.
That's true. That there, I would agree with you. But you know,
it's sort of like who pays
one
the bills
at the philosophical debate about whether U.S. Hegemonic dominance is bad for the world or good for the world. My guess is, Scott, that you and I don't see exactly eye to eye on that. I personally think that the U.S. can, not always has, but can be a very, very stabilizing force for both security and the economy if it has hegemonic power, but it uses it in a prudent and benign way. And so, you know, my concern is not that the U.S. has great power. My concern is that the U.S. has misused its great power.
And how long in a row has that got to go on before you?
Hegemon, but essentially has acted like a bull in a china shop. And Libya is really, you know, exhibit A in that argument.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, how long in a row has that got to go on before you maybe decide that it can't be a wise and patient hegemon, that Madeleine Albright was wrong, that we stand taller and see further into the future? We're actually run by a bunch of Bushes and Clintons and Obamas and Trumps around here. Kagans.
You sound like my old professor who was my advisor on my dissertation. He agrees with you. He thinks that great, you know, power corrupts and great power corrupts, absolute power corrupts absolutely. So if the U.S. has all this power, we will, in fact, misuse it. And he would point to Iraq and Libya, et cetera, as examples of it. But the alternative is for the U.S. to pull back from the world. And if you think that that is going to go as peaches and cream, I would disagree with you. We have Trump pulling back from the world. He pulls back, doesn't care about Hong Kong, doesn't care about East Asia. And
he's escalated every war he got from Obama, every one of them.
Well, I mean, but it's not I would disagree with you. He's reduced the number of troops in Syria. He's reduced the number of troops in Afghanistan. He has stopped hectoring places, you know, about human rights. And it has not made the world more peaceful. It has not made the U.S. more secure. So just because the U.S. has abused its power in the past doesn't mean that the answer is isolationism. I think that the real answer is to try to use that that great power in a more prudent way. And it's possible. You know, you take a look, you know, prudent, that was the joke they used to make about George Herbert Walker Bush, you know, Bush 41. But he had it right. You know, Iraq invades Kuwait, go in, kick his butt, kick him out, and then come home. That's the prudent use of force. And
but
so,
he didn't. He left the troops there.
It can be done. But people have to go to school. They have to study. They have to be experts. You know what? And you know, and not to be flippant, but if you elect this president, somebody whose resume is that he's a renovator of hotels and a reality TV host, then you're not going to get the prudent use of American force.
Okay, couple things
Obama,
here, though.
Obama was no expert either when we elected him. Obama was no expert. Let's elect a president who actually knows something about national security and the prudent use of American force. And then maybe you come around to my side and say, yeah, we actually can be a force for good in the world and also safeguard American security.
Okay, couple things there. First of all, George Bush Sr. left the troops in Saudi Arabia to wage Iraq War 1.5 for the next decade, which I know you know, is what caused the September 11th attack against the United States, as Paul Wolfowitz said, was the major reason for bin Laden's war against the U.S., was those troops bombing Iraq from those bases in Saudi where Bush left them. And the other point I would like to make, since he was the prudent, reasonable one, he started this 30-year war against a country that never attacked us or did anything to us, and that, in fact, Bush's government had told, go ahead and take the northern oil fields, we don't care, in the first place. And then secondly, there are no isolationists in this country anywhere, and I think you know that is such a straw man argument. Even Pat Buchanan is not an isolationist, Alan. And, you know, certainly you could be a non-interventionist without being an isolationist at all. Thomas Jefferson said, peace and commerce and open, honest friendship with all nations. and alliances with none, permanent alliances at least, with none. So how come we can't just be a republic at peace? How come our choice is either this false choice of isolationism or global empire?
Honestly, my answer is that the world doesn't take care of itself. And, you know, the key thing that the world needs is for countries to act in concert. And that doesn't just happen. It typically requires a great power to come together, to bring countries together, but to be the leader that brings countries together so that countries can act together in their mutual interest. And that is what I'm talking about. And that is different than what you're talking about. Okay, you can say, oh, I don't mean isolationism. You can say, well, I just want sort of a restraint. But restraint means, you know, coming home, looking inward. And what I'm saying is that for the world to be stable, both in terms of the economy and in terms of security, it requires countries to act together. And that requires the U.S. to be outward looking and to take a leadership role internationally, simply because we're the biggest power. If we weren't the biggest power, it wouldn't matter. We could come home and it would have no impact, would make no difference. But if we don't lead, nobody is going to lead. Or even worse, China might lead. And honestly, my friend, I do not want a world where an authoritarian, essentially fascist government is the leader of the international community making rules for you and me.
Well, I think that's a real overblown threat. But, you know, we talked earlier about, or you mentioned earlier about, you know, the Iranians made this deal and our government, yeah, under Trump, whichever, threw that deal out. I mean, it's a miracle Obama got the thing done in the first place. But he threw that deal out and he reinstituted an even worse economic war against Iran than Obama had under his crippling sanctions, which is, in other words, there's not all very much stability. If you're a Somali and America, JSOC and CIA have been killing your country since 2001, or if you're a Yemeni and you're under naval blockade and carpet bombing by American-backed Saudis, or, you know, why are these people the sacrificial lambs for this stability that I don't know where it exists? American dominance in Europe spreads stability there, maybe, you think, or what?
First of all, don't ask me to defend the Trump administration's policies.
Well, I'm asking you to defend anything that happened since the end of the Cold War. I mean,
I didn't love the Iran deal, but once you make a deal, you should stick with the deal, not undermine your credibility, not undermine your alliances by unilaterally pulling out of the deal and punishing a country that agreed to a non-proliferation
deal. How about the 30-year war against Iraq?
That was ridiculous. I'm sorry?
How about the 30-year war against Iraq, or the 20-year now war against Somalia, or the war in Afghanistan?
See, I mean, Scott, the one thing you're ignoring is the fact that in some of these cases, there are really bad actors who really want to do us harm. And sometimes, you know, they're in the Islamic world and sometimes they're Sunni groups such as Al-Qaeda or the Islamic State. And sometimes they're Shiite groups sponsored by Iran, whether it be Hezbollah or whether it be the Houthi rebels in Yemen. And you can, you know, pull back from the world and say, okay, we're going to leave, much of the Middle East, the greater Middle East, to these radical Islamists and say, but that's far away, no problem. But you know what? It's not far away, because we learned on 9/11 that these folks can hurt us at home. And so there is some truth to the old argument that if we don't get them there, they're going to get us here. And I really do think we have a need to confront these folks. Now, the question is how to do it. And I would completely agree with you that sometimes not only do we not help the situation, but we hurt the situation. We hurt our own interests and we hurt, you know, the interests of civilians overseas. So to me, you know, it's why I'm not an anti-interventionist. I'm anti-dumb intervention.
Yeah. Well, I mean, as I think you know, there were about 400 to 1,000 Al-Qaeda guys in the whole world in 2001. And there are 40-something thousand of them now. because of all these wars. At that time, they didn't have a prayer in the world of doing a coup against any state anywhere. And they didn't even control a single county. They had a farm outside of Kandahar. They had the lion's den hiding in the White Mountains on the border between nowhere and nothing. They couldn't have overthrown the government of Saudi or Iraq or any of this or Yemen. They need America to do all of this for them. It's not much of a counterterrorism policy when you look at it here from especially 2020 hindsight, you got to admit.
No, you're right. I mean, you know, what we should have done is knocked off Al-Qaeda and the Taliban in Afghanistan and then come home. We certainly shouldn't have gone into Iraq. We certainly shouldn't have gone into Libya. And those things did prove to be recruiting tools for Al-Qaeda and then later ISIS. So, yeah, you know, I agree with you. But should we have done nothing? No. There, maybe I disagree with you. I think we had to go, you know, the Taliban supported Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda flew three planes into buildings in the United States and killed 3,000 innocent Americans. And we asked the Taliban to turn over Al-Qaeda. The Taliban said, go to hell. And at that point, we had to take down the Taliban. So we had to do something, but we did way too much for way too long, and that proved counterproductive. So I'll agree with you on the second part, but maybe we'll have to agree to disagree on the first part.
Yeah, and that's fine. And I hope I wasn't too argumentative with you here, but us non-interventionists need you realists to move a little bit further toward non-intervention and be a little bit more realistic here, man. But great to talk to you, and great work again on the Libya case for sure. Really appreciate it.
Okay, and as I say, if anybody wants, you know, the chapter and verse, all the footnotes, all the YouTube videos, it's in this article that I published in Genocide Studies and Prevention, and that's free download, and you can get the link on my site, Cooperman.com.
Okay, great. And that's Cooperman.com. And then the short version is here at the National Interest, America's little known mission to support Al-Qaeda's role in Libya. And rewind back to this one at Boston.com years ago. False pretense for war in Libya.
That National Interest article, it's a short article. It took me 7 years to figure out. So I would urge everyone to take a look at it.
Good work. Yeah. All right. Appreciate it very much, Alan.
Okay. Thank you.
All right, y'all, thanks. Find me at libertarianinstitute.org, at scotthorton.org, antiwar.com, and reddit.com/Scott Horton Show. Oh, yeah, and read my book, Fool's Errand, Timed and the War in Afghanistan, at foolserrand.us.